smart means that you get smart by learning. And one of the things that I've always thought is that we need to really rebrand how we think about cities and to think about them more as experiments and to learn from all the data that cities providing. So, you know, whether that be sort of in a conventional IBM-y kind of way where we're scraping ambient data off of cell phones, or if that be something a little bit more pointed, like putting, like I do, putting heat sensors around Los Angeles to see how the city is performing. That's all learning so that we can make better decisions to make cities better places for people to live.
Hi, Smart Community friends. In this jam-packed episode of the Smart Community Podcast, I have a great conversation with Dr. Kelly Turner, an assistant professor of urban planning at UCLA. Kelly begins by telling us about her current role and affiliations, her interests and diverse background starting in politics, and how her passion for research then led her to a PhD in geography. And Kelly also tells us what a smart community is to her and how her current work fits into the smart community space. Kelly then dives into the urban heat island effect and discusses some of the factors that contribute to heat retention in cities. She talks about how communities can make cooler decisions and what factors contribute to reducing heat. We talk about the need to flip the script on heat retention issues, have better accountability and better ways to measure these issues to drive change. Kelly then tells us about cool paint and some examples of how it can reduce surface temperatures in cities before we discuss the pros and cons of technology and the second order impacts associated. Kelly then shares some examples of how communities in the US are working towards more heat resilient cities, how some communities are more vulnerable than others, and shares some examples of the data and technology she uses to measure heat. We finish our conversation talking about the emerging trends of innovative and inventive ways to deal with and mitigate heat and make cities more palatable. As always, we hope you enjoy listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
Welcome to the smart community, smart regions, smart towns, and smart cities. It's where we live, work, and play. With smart communities, the future starts today. Big data, smart mobility, emerging trends galore. The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.
Hello, Kelly. How are you today?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I am doing very well. I'm excited to have you on the podcast. So let's just jump straight in. And can you tell us about your background and what you are passionate about?
Yeah, so I am an assistant professor of urban planning at UCLA. I'm also affiliated with the Geography Department and the Institute of Environment and Sustainability. And I play a lot of hats there. I'm also currently the Associate Director of Urban Environment Research at the Luskin Center for Innovation, which is a policy-leaning research think tank center at UCLA. And on August 15th, I'll be taking over as co-interim director of that center. And my background is, in a former life, I used to want to be in politics. So I was a staffer and a legislative aide, but I abandoned that path because I was passionate about research and went to graduate school. And I had a rather unconventional training. My PhD is in geography, but I was part of this program run by the NSF at that point, in which I had to minor in a different discipline. So I've always been sort of agnostic to disciplinary leaning. And I think that gives me an interesting perspective on a lot of sort of environmental issues about cities.
Awesome. And yeah, it sounds like you've got lots of time on your hands. I imagine that stuff would keep you so busy. And I can relate to doing, I guess, a whole bunch of different things, but all relating back into that, you know, for me, the smart community stuff. So yeah, no, it sounds really interesting. Well, let's talk about smart communities then. And how do you think that what you do fits into this smart community space?
Yeah, so, you know, I wouldn't typically say that I was a smart community scholar, but that when I was thinking about the question, I thought, you know, maybe I am, because what does smart mean, really? Smart means that you get smart by learning. And one of the things that I've always thought is that we need to really rebrand how we think about cities and to think about them more as experiments and to learn from all the data that cities providing. So, you know, whether that be sort of in a conventional IBM-y kind of way where we're scraping ambient data off of cell phones, or if that be something a little bit more pointed, like putting heat sensors around Los Angeles to see how the city is performing. That's all learning so that we can make better decisions to make cities better places for people to live.
And you've already started talking about this, but overall, what is a smart community to you?
To me, a smart community is one that is responsive to the information and the scientific information that is provided. I mean, I say responsive, and I intentionally don't say, you know, data driven or whatever, because I think a lot of the information we have, there's more than one good decision that can stem from the data. So there's always this important sort of social science component, thinking about equitable distribution of resources, or thinking about, you know, what are our long-term goals and what are the trade-offs and co-benefits?
Yeah, no, that's so true. And like, you must think about a lot of things very spatially in the work that you do. And I imagine obviously cities, there's a very spatial component to that. In terms of smart communities, like when we're thinking more, I think a lot of people think like tech, and you know, we talk about this a lot on the podcast. It's not about tech, it's about the people, but it's also about the spaces and the places that we're living in. And I guess like you're looking at this heat island effect as well. So let's jump into that. Let's talk about some of the projects and things that you've been working on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so most of my work recently focuses on cities and heat. And I guess if I were going to communicate one thing to your audience about heat, it's that heat is actually several problems, but they all tend to be sort of mushed up and conflated in our minds as one thing. So everyone grows up watching the weather, and you hear, you know, the temperature today is going to be whatever it's going to be. And that's one measurement of heat. That's air temperature that we're learning about. And then some people may have seen these beautiful sort of high resolution red and orange maps, especially recently with all of the like crazy events going on. And those tend to be satellite driven data. Those are estimates of something we call land surface temperature or near land surface temperature that's coming from satellite imagery. And that's where a lot of our information about the urban heat island has come. So we've known for over 40, 50 years unequivocally that if you take away vegetation and you add a bunch of low albedo, not very reflective asphalt surfaces, that you make cities hotter than the surrounding region. So that's another bucket. And then there's this third bucket of heat, which is something that most people are not familiar with, called mean radiant temperature. And that's how the body experiences heat. So we experience heat as sunlight coming and hitting us, as radiative energy coming off of all the surfaces around us, as airflow. And so basically those three problems, those three types of temperature, air temperature, surface temperature, and radiant temperature, speak to different aspects of the urban heat problem. So I've spent a lot of time trying to understand how the built environment contributes to each of those.
Yeah, no, so interesting. And I think, yeah, that is true. There's so many elements to that, and then also what we can do about it as well. So what are some of the things that really contribute to, obviously, you know, other than the obvious, what are some of the things that maybe aren't so obvious that really contribute to the heat island effect?
Yeah, so there's sort of two ways to answer that problem. There's what in terms of the urban land is contributing to the heat island, and there's what's in terms of our decision-making that's contributing to the problem. And we really know quite well in terms of urban land what contributes to the urban heat island. And that is buildings, roads, taking away vegetation, anything that's going to cause sunlight to be stored in surfaces and slowly re-radiated out as heat in the late afternoon and evening time. That's causing the heat island. I also want to like put a little asterisk. I hear oftentimes the heat island being used as sort of this local neighborhood scale thing, like the heat island in my neighborhood, which is not really a correct thing to say, because it should really be, and a lot of people say, the regional heat island, right? And you know, some people don't even think heat island is a good term for urban planning anyway, because it's so comparative and regional in scope, rather than saying my neighbor's hot, why, right? So that's one sort of bucket of issues that has to do with the biophysical, the climate, right? The other thing is our decision-making. I think that we often think about dealing with heat in the outdoor environment, at least as things like tree planting programs. And I love trees, and I think trees are fantastic, and we need more of them. However, every decision that we make in a city about buildings, roads, street widths, how tall the building is, how close the building is together, all of those are either hot decisions or cool decisions. And they're not thought of in that sort of package. We think about mitigating with vegetation, but not stopping the stuff that we're already doing that contributes to heat. So a great example of this, the streets, this is coming out of some of my conversation with our local streets department, is that, great, we can have Los Angeles planting a million trees, and that's a wonderful thing to do. However, every time we densify our housing, there are certain areas where that triggers automatic street width widenings, and that triggers street tree removals. And so on aggregate, nobody knows this, but my guess would be on aggregate that all those kinds of decisions contribute way more to making the city hot than any sort of vegetative planting is and making our cities cool.
So what are some of the things that we can do to combat that, or I guess input into that decision making to negate some of that, or not me, I don't want to even use the word mitigate, but just, you know, make cooler decisions.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's really interesting that you're sort of going back and forth over the term mitigate, because obviously, you know, you probably know mitigation and adaptation, things can get a little hairy there, right? And a lot of the conversation right now has been focused on extreme heat events. So these heat waves, these record, it's hard to even point to a specific example today because there have been so many specific examples recently of extreme heat events. And the interesting thing is that extreme heat events are actually technically climate anomalies that we have very little control over, right? And so when we talk about the built environment in the context of extreme heat events, they get talked about in terms of an adaptation choice. So you hear things like, we're going to have more frequent heat waves. They're going to be hotter. They're going to be worse. So what can we do to the built environment to moderate that, to make it less horrible for us, right? But if you think about it, if you flip the script a little bit, which is what I was hoping to do in the recent op-ed that I wrote, say, well, actually, this could be mitigation because the built environment produces heat. So if you think about the problem not as this climate anomaly, extreme heat event thing, and you frame it as the urban heat island, or you frame it as, you know, urban heat production, or the term that I used somewhat provocatively, urban heat pollution, then it becomes a mitigation strategy. We're mitigating the production of urban heat pollution.
I like that term. Well, I don't like that term, but it is a provocative term. And I think it's an interesting one to bring it to the level of pollution, because you can have different conversations about it then, right? That it's actually this problem. It's just like, you know, like air pollution and noise pollution, and it's heat pollution because it makes things uncomfortable for us and the environment. And it's causing, you know, death, right? It's causing all those types of things. So why not call it pollution? It's interesting.
Yeah. And it also opens up regulatory avenues. So, you know, one of the things is even that we've heard extreme heat causes more deaths than other weather-related disasters. And by the way, those are usually based on really conservative estimates. However, we don't have mature governance structures or organizations or responsible entities dealing with heat the way we have, like, a flood management plan or a wildfire plan, right? We don't have heat plans. That's starting to change a little. So Miami has their first heat officer that they have in place now. And we have in California something called the Cool Community. AB 585 heat resilience legislation put in place. And it's, you know, it has strong support, and we hope that it's going to move through. But the big issue is if you have a problem and nobody's charged with addressing it, then it probably won't be addressed. And so by using the term pollution, that's a very sort of specific entree point in the US context to the Environmental Protection Agency being able to have authority to regulate something, and also to impose or enforce our environmental justice mandate, which we have through them.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. I had a really good conversation with the former chief data officer of New York City, and he talked similarly, not about heat, but about data and the responsibility of, or who's responsible for making sure that the data is used well and good decisions are made. And if they're not, then what do we do about it? And those type of things. But until someone's accountable and responsible at that level, then it's all well and good and everyone can high five about the small things that we do. But until someone's responsible for it, it's like waste, for example, like if someone doesn't pick up my waste, you know, my rubbish, my trash, then I'm going to be able to say something about it and someone will fix it because someone's responsible for it, local government, for example. But if it's, yeah, if you don't have someone responsible for it, then stuff can't move because it just becomes tokenistic, or, you know, pilots happen and that's great, but the scalability isn't there and doesn't move into full operation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And another issue is that, you know, to link the information and the regulation and responsibility all together, a lot of our information that cities have their hands on are these land surface temperature maps. And I'm going to go into the weeds for a second, but it's super important. So the land surface temperature maps show us reflectance. They really highlight the role of this thing called albedo, this reflectance of different surfaces. And so if you look at those maps, you automatically see places that have high albedo, like vegetated surfaces, or cool surfaces, white solar reflective paint. Those surfaces automatically show up as lowering the temperature in the city. And if you want to solve the urban heat island problem, then absolutely. I mean, you could, in theory, you couldn't really do this because of laws and land use issues. But in theory, if you painted the whole city white, it would be cooler in terms of land surface temperature. However, when you reflect solar energy, it goes somewhere. And it goes onto the nearest body that it's approximate to. So if that is a human body, you're reflecting heat back at a human body. And so I did a study with one of my colleagues, Ariana Medel at Arizona State University, and she has this fantastic biometeorology equipment that we take out. It's like a wagon, and its name is MARTI. with the acronym MRT in it, so MARTI. And we took some measurements. Los Angeles has been this vanguard in terms of putting cool pavement down on streets. So we dragged this cart around all day long in the valley. It was very, very hot, and took all these measurements. And we found what we kind of knew we would find, which is that the cool paint was very, very effective at reducing the surface temperature like cities thought it would. But it did reflect energy back. And so at certain times of the day, between about 11 o'clock and 1 o'clock-ish, it's hotter for the pedestrian to be directly on that surface. And so that's an example where using the tools that are widely available for decision making, you know, it makes sense from one perspective, but not another. And so we need to have sort of a more nuanced conversation in our governance of heat to account for that. Now, I want to put a big asterisk because I don't want to get in trouble here with that study, which is that A, it's one day, one area. But B, the cool paint was functioning fairly similarly to concrete, the whiter colored concrete that we make sidewalks out of. And, you know, people walk on that. But I think the other big important thing to come out of that study is that it really, that's that qualitative bit that I was talking about, that normative bit. So, you know, it really depends how space is used. So a great example would be, should we be focusing schoolyards, like where kids play at school at recess? Should we be painting those, which in LA, in a lot of the US, and I'm not sure in other regions, we give kids like giant asphalt yards to play on for recess. And those are hot and kind of undesirable. And so one of the things that our legislation would do in California, if it passes, is say that we should prioritize schoolyards for cool pavement. Now, I can't say whether that's the right or the wrong priority from the science, but I can tell you that it's going to do two things. One is desirable and one's not. It's going to make the surface cooler. So if kids touch it, they're less likely to burn their skin. But it's also going to reflect heat right in the middle of the day when kids have recess and make them feel hotter when they're running around on it.
Yeah. So it's like, and I think this is the same with like any, like with technology, for example. You know, you have some really great things that it might do, but then you have some negative things, and we've got to work out which one do we really, really want this, or do we need this? And how do we, I guess, combat some of the negative things, or can we accept them if they're minor things, and then we can work on those as issues? It's interesting, like, this is a different example, but when I was in Amsterdam, you know, people talk about Amsterdam, you know, they've got like great traffic, or what's the word? They've just got a really good transport network, right? And lots of bicycles, et cetera, et cetera. And so when I went there, people were like, oh, well, what did you look at? You know, they've got it all sorted. And I said, well, no, they have these like second order, like, traffic problems that, you know, Australia would love to have, which is bicycle parking is an issue. Bicycle congestion is an issue, right? So it's not like it stops and just like, oh, cool, now we've solved the city. You don't solve mobility, you don't solve the city. But it's similarly with this stuff. It's like, okay, well, we've got this, and then what are we going to do about this next? And I think that what are we going to do? We need to start thinking about those things when we are making the decisions now, which is where we, I think, a lot of the time go, oh, well, cool, that's the decision, we're done, tick. It's then, well, what are we doing about those second order impacts and effects, which, you know, obviously has a lot of application outside of heat as well. But when you were talking there, it really reminded me of that there's, it's not just like a one-stop thing and then we've solved everything. But I'm really keen to hear, are there any places that are doing this really well, like where they're moving towards having cooler cities?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is, so I'm part of the Arsht Rockefeller Extreme Heat Resilience Alliance Scientific Advisory Committee. That's a mouthful. And so our job, so this is really, I mean, there's a group of folks globally that are thinking deeply about how to make heat resilient communities. And they've tasked a bunch of scholars with coming and helping to advise them through that process. But right now it's very experimental. You know, I would really advise, my advice to that community is that you embrace the fact that you don't know. So, like, much with the LA streets example, you know, I think it's fantastic that they're doing that. And I think it's fantastic that they partnered with a bunch of scholars to try to figure out what's going to happen. And I would, you know, that's what I think should continue to happen. So, for instance, here's an example. In Southern California, we have a bunch of these state-funded communities called transformative climate communities. And what this is funding directly to, defined as disadvantaged communities, to implement climate adaptation strategies. And these are built hard interventions to adapt to climate change. And so my group is going out and partnering with the communities. So we're in Watts, in the Valley. We even have a site way out in East Coachella Valley, which I can talk about more. And we're looking at what they plan to, we're modeling the thermal conditions now in a really robust way for them. And then we're talking to the stakeholders and the community members about places of interest to them and what might happen in the future in their communities. And then we're going to model that for them. We're going to run some scenarios and then bring that back to them and hopefully help them make more informed decisions about, you know, so the thermal conditions of their community in the future.
Yeah, no, it sounds really, and then you'll look at like interventions and then measure and model those again, I guess.
Yeah. We have a number of these kind of projects going on. So another one that I would like to highlight is it's a multi-collaborator interdisciplinary project called Heat Resilient Los Angeles that is just getting underway. We're doing a couple interesting things that might be of interest to your listeners. One of the things that we do with heat maps is they tend to be stagnant, right? They just show where people are. And we assume wherever people live, that's where we should be targeting interventions. So you live in a hot neighborhood, so you probably need more trees there. However, people are exposed to heat in a variety of different contexts as they move about the city in the day. So we're going to be using cell phone mobility data to try to understand where people move throughout the day and then compare that to some of the thermal data that we have. And think about, you know, can we target at a city level? Can we make cool corridors, for instance? Maybe we don't need to just put cooling interventions where it's hottest, but we need to put them where people go that are hottest. And then on the flip side, if we have an extreme heat event, where do people naturally go to get cool? You know, one of the most pernicious issues is that you can provide cooling centers. Maybe people can't get there, or maybe people don't want to go sit in like a boring gymnasium somewhere all day, right? So, you know, maybe there are places people already go that we can make even cooler for them during those events.
That's so interesting. because it's like the whole of journey, right? Like, just if my house is cool, that's great. But if I'm going to go to the shops, I'm going to, if it's hot and there's no other option, I'm going to jump in my car and drive there, which, you know, then just negates or accelerates the issue or whatever. Whereas if I've got this cool corridor, then I can, you know, either walk or cycle or whatever, then like then it will make sense to do that. And then more and more people are doing that. And then we have more, you know, we can have more infrastructure, we can invest in that, et cetera. So it's that whole of journey. And it's you know, it's like transport planning where you have a network, like you're actually looking at a network, not just, oh, that's really hot, so what are we going to do about that? And then also the cooling places, yeah, I'm just thinking like, you know, the library or places that communities already go, what can we look at those and make them cooler, and also cooler in the sense of like maybe you can do activities there, there's, I don't know, technology or whatever, I don't know, workshops and things that then you can have there, because then that facility becomes a multidisciplinary, you know, different community groups can go there and also get away from the heat. So it'd be really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I think that oftentimes we plan for what we can see. And what we see is so dependent on the kind of data that we have. And that's the problem here with the stagnant maps versus the more dynamic mobility-based maps. But it's bigger than that. So, you know, if we, for instance, if we do take an urban heat island approach and we're looking at land surface temperature maps, we're not seeing the thermal conditions that pedestrians are exposed to, or we're not seeing rural areas, which are hugely impacted, not by, you know, so for instance, I said I could say more about this in the Coachella Valley. I've started some work out in a town called Oasis. It is a predominantly agricultural community, and they mostly live in mobile homes. And so they're incredibly vulnerable to heat, but they're not vulnerable to heat in the same way somebody living in the San Fernando Valley is vulnerable to heat. And so, you know, the stories out there, I mean, are absolutely heartbreaking. And you think about climate adaptation strategies for heat, and like, there's a lot of talk about, for instance, air conditioning compounding the problem of climate change and extreme temperatures. But, you know, if we're going to accept trade-offs, it seems to me that the communities that we want to accept them in are those communities, the folks that are most vulnerable. You know, another example of that is here, there's been a push in some arenas to save water and to do so through using artificial turf. From a heat perspective, artificial turf is absolutely the hottest of all surfaces. I mean, it might as well be pavement. And so do we really want to be putting artificial turf on a school or like a place where people are recreating and exerting themselves, especially children? Well, I think that's a place where we accept the trade-off and we direct water resources, because that's going to be the most vulnerable group. But again, that's a good example of, to take this, my comment full circle, of we don't see artificial turf as being hot. It's always been such a small pocket of land use, and we're always looking regionally at cities. And so very few kind of academic studies have been examining heat dimensions of artificial turf, just because it's not a large enough land cover. When we make land cover maps, we do, you know, vegetation, impervious surface, soils. You don't see artificial turf as one of the land cover categories because it's so small. But if you zoom down and care about super local, hyper local conditions, then you do see those nuances.
Yeah. And we need both of those, you know, views, right? We need the regional view like you were talking about, but yeah, you do need that hyper local view as well. I mean, it's a bit like, you know, I've got my global communities, and particularly during COVID, my global communities were amazing because you could connect with people or whatever, but then I actually became really hyper local as well, where I'm just like, oh, my yoga crew became, you know, I don't know, we started talking more because that's the only people we saw from a distance, obviously in a mask. And so, yeah, you kind of have those two, and you need both of those views in this space as well. And I think similar with smart communities, it's like you can have the big strategy and the vision and all that type of stuff, but if you can't execute at a detailed level, then you won't be able to achieve those goals. And I think that multidisciplinary approach is really important too, and bring those experts in, like you were saying, like you want someone to really be looking, really caring about, you know, the artificial turf, so then they can come in and you can get the information. And I know there's people out there like that, and we love them, because I have some loves about traffic signage and those type of things. So I get, but yeah, it's It is really interesting. I want to zoom to the future about emerging trends, but first I want to talk a little bit. Can you just share with the audience a bit about the data that you use? Just for, because I'm sure they're wondering, like, how do we actually measure this data and technology that you use to actually measure heat?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great. So the very first set of data that most people in my field use is remote sensing data. And usually that's land surface temperature maps. And, you know, that's pretty straightforward. I think that's kind of well-trodden territory. We know what we're going to find when we look at those. And it's a matter of just how high resolution the data is. And it's pretty high resolution these days, which is fortunate. And so when we look at that data, we see this estimate of near surface land surface temperature, and we see that it correlates to vegetative cover and it correlates to albedo. Now, the second set of data that you can use are surface temperature radars. And that's, I mean, they're like $10 a pop at Home Depot or whatever, and you can shine them on whatever surface you want and know what the surface temperature is. And that's interesting because if you compare the estimates from land surface temperature remote sensing and the surface temperature guns, you see that the radars show much higher surface temperatures than you get from remote sensing data. So there's a, you know, you get, it's worse. Then the next kind of thing that you can do is look at air temperature. And so that can either come from weather stations if you're doing a regional study, but that can also come from, we use these little things called eye buttons. They look like little key fobs almost. They're the size of your thumb. And they collect really great longitudinal. You can set them up for a month. We nail them to trees with little Dixie cups to protect them for the weather. And they sit out for a month and they can collect, you know, every 10 seconds a data point on the temperature and humidity. And there are other kind of sensors like that. But all they tell you is the air temperature. And then the other thing that we do is we use these things called Kestrel sensors. And they can take a variety of different sort of climate measurements, wind speed, humidity, other things. And those can sit out for a day or so, but they're a little more expensive. So you wouldn't want to leave them hanging on trees for a month out in public. And then the best sensor we have is the one that I mentioned before, MARTI. My colleague has, she invented MARTI essentially, which can directly take surface temperature. It tells you incoming and outgoing radiance. It tells you everything at very high time scales. And it's great because there are other machines like this that people are using, but usually they put them on like cars and drive them around. And the great thing about MARTI is you can take MARTI off-road. So we've dragged MARTI through washes and pedestrian paths and all sorts of things. And then once we have the data, you can either take a look at the raw data and say, okay, you know, we for instance, had MARTI sitting on a grass field all day. Let's look at what happened to all the different measures of temperature. Or you can take all those data points and simulate in a modeling environment. You interpolate what the whole area might have looked like. And that way you can say a whole neighborhood. But it's incredibly time intensive in terms of field work and in terms of just producing and running the models. So it doesn't have that sort of ease factor that the remote sensing data does. So one of the questions we're exploring right now is the extent to which those satellite derived estimates are, you know, good enough, or if there's some sort of areas where they have limits that we should know that we need other types of measurements to get at.
Mm, yeah, cool. I think we could talk all day about data, but I'm doing a project at the moment and maybe we can talk offline. Okay, let's talk about the future. Let's zoom to the future now. What are the emerging trends in this space that people aren't talking about enough?
The emerging trends in terms of the technology or adaptation strategies?
Whatever you reckon.
However I interpret it. Well, we're in this odd moment right now for heat because every summer, by the way, we get this sort of spike in the conversation about heat. I get contacted way more to like talk to in newspapers about heat. And that's because it's hotter. And this year has been exceptional. And last year was exceptional because of COVID and people being outside and being at home. And so I think, you know, we're kind of at this really great moment for heat where, you know, unfortunately, it's really bad, but fortunately, it's getting more of the attention that it deserves. And so I think what we need to be talking about are these innovative ideas that people are putting forth for dealing with, adapting to, and mitigating heat. So one of them that's maybe a little bit controversial is associated with this group, the Extreme Heat Resilience Alliance, that I'm a part of. And they put forth this proposal that we should start naming heat waves as a way to sort of promote response to heat, to increase awareness. And, you know, I think that's an interesting proposal. I think it's, you know, there are a lot of question marks about whether you can actually do that, if that you can apply some sort of universal standard for what would constitute to a name. There's issues, there's subjectivity issues around naming and anthropomizing a heat wave, but we really don't know. So, I mean, I think that would be a great idea to do at like a really small scale, maybe in a community, do a pilot study. And we have things like social media data. I did a study a while back on naming blizzards. We could do the same kind of thing. You can just monitor what happens when you give a heat wave a name and how does that compare to places that are not using the heat wave name. So that's one thing. Another thing that could be in the future is taking a cue from COVID. So a lot of cities have changed their laws and codes so that we can move more of our activities outdoors, like, you know, outdoor dining and stuff. I mean, what if we thought about cooling centers, not just in terms of like a library and designating that as a place people go, but what if we thought about having pop-up cool events where we had sprinklers and things, just like taking a cue, learning from the past year and adapting somewhat. Yeah. So I think that's where I would like to see the conversation go, away from just, you know, trees, as wonderful as trees are and how we need shade, but towards like all these really inventive things we can do to make the cities more palatable in the future.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. No pun intended.
But that's okay. I did a series of these murals, or we've been doing these solar reflective murals on the sides of buildings using the paint, because a lot of people don't know it's not just white, it's lots of colors, right? And that was sort of an awareness campaign for heat. But, you know, we couldn't help ourselves. We've been calling them like cool murals because it's like cool art. It's hip, it's cool, but it's also physically cool to touch.
Yes, love it when, you know, like, I don't know, artsy and creative and geeks and nerds get together and, you know, talk about that. Yeah, love it. Well, Kelly, it's been so great to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I feel like we could talk for a lot longer, but we will wrap it up there. I just got one last question, which is how can people connect with you?
Yeah, so they can contact me via Twitter, @VKellyTurner. I also have an Instagram page, Linda_collaborative, which is where you can see those cool murals. And they can find, I have a website through UCLA, a faculty website that has all my email contact information, and the website for the Luskin Center for Innovation.
Cool. We'll put all the links in the show notes so people can click away and find you. Thank you again for coming onto the podcast.
All right. Thank you so much. It was a lot of fun.
We'll talk soon. Bye.
Bye.
The Smart Community Podcast is brought to you by My Smart Community. If you're trying to deal with disruption, not sure what technologies to buy, need to facilitate genuine collaboration, then we can help. Email hello@mysmart.community or head to www.mysmart.community/consulting.
Thanks so much for listening to the Smart Community Podcast. Show notes for this episode and all other episodes are available on our website, mysmart.community/podcast. If you have any questions for us or any of our guests, you can email hello@mysmart.community. You can also find us on the socials. We are on LinkedIn and Twitter @smartcomhq. That's com with two M's. If you are enjoying the podcast, please hit subscribe so you never miss an episode. And we would love for you to leave us a rating and review at wherever you listen. This really helps us reach more ears and eyes, so thank you for your support. As always, we hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.